If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I am Alex.
I am Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we're coming to you live from a couple of places on the internet. We are live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Instagram, Kick, of course, and LinkedIn. Pete, how's it going for you? You getting any of those LinkedIn fish?
Nope. But thanks. Am I fishing?
We've been freelance too long. We don't know what you getting any fish in your job, huh?
No man? Fish here. No
the
fish
stash
here,
lives. Jeff. That's right, Derek Mainhart.
Yes. Justin still has his mustache for anybody who's listening later on audio. And if you're listening on Apple, Android, Spotify, wherever you're listening, that's all good. Just want to mention, if you want ad-free versions of this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. But listen, we're going to keep
on
this
Kick,
stash.
We all have mustaches, I believe.
Yeah, and Justin, do you want to take this time to plug your stash's Instagram handle? Or
no, the Justash?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, you definitely
hashtag Justash.
Follow Justash on Instagram.
Well, it's like a cross between old Jordache commercials and your mustache. It's quite beautiful.
You can tell that, like, Pete, when a single thing changes in any of our lives, like 15 years ago, I had like a bump on my head that I had removed. And Pete talked about it for longer than my children are old. And it's amazing. I know I'm going to talk about having a mustache for years now, even when I have like a Santa beard like Pete.
Ah, man. That hurts.
By the way, your season's coming up, Pete. That's pretty exciting.
That's right, yeah. Kids are starting to look at me weird. Yeah.
Are you allowed to go back to the mall yet?
Nope. No, okay. Not yet.
All right. We won't get into it.
For those of you that don't know, Pete accidentally killed a Santa on his roof and is in a real Santa Claus with an ease situation. So just help
Well, the beard's definitely come in. How about the gut, Pete? You got the gut yet?
You know it.
All right. Great. Working on that whole Santa Claus. Listen, we're working on having some amazing guests for the show. And in fact, we did it. We got it. We nailed it. We have three amazing guests for you tonight. They are three guys behind an awesome, I guess we could call it project, called the Marvel Age of Comics. Three different books to kick off this new line of books delving into some of the really fascinating history behind Marvel Comics that you may or may not know. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Ryle, Paul Cornell, and Stuart Moore.
Hey, welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you guys so much for coming. Very excited to chat about this. So there are, as I mentioned, three different books. They all came out, I believe, today from Bloomsbury. And just to read off what they are, Chris's book is Daredevil Born Again, and delving pretty heavily into that. Stuart, you wrote about Doctor Strange, A Decade of Dark Magic. And Paul, you wrote about The Mighty Avengers versus the 1970s. And very excited to find out which one of them won, I guess. We'll talk about that in a moment. But just to take a big step back and talk about this, like, we've interviewed all three of you guys for vastly different projects before, and nothing against you, but they're not necessarily three names that I would expect to see together on a roster. How did they end up reaching out to you about this, and what kind of coordination, if anything, was there on this, or were you kind of just all set on your own paths?
See, where do we start? Who starts? Stuart, you want to start?
I think we were all reached out to separately. Marvel recommended most of us, I think. But actually, we all do know each other. And we've all worked together on various different projects in the past. So it was really nice to, like, I didn't even know Paul and Chris were writing the books until I was well into mine. And then I was great. Like, my friends. I'm here with friends. That worked out nicely. The books themselves are there's something you don't get to do very often, because they are Marvel licensed, but they're almost sort of a cross to varying degrees for each of us. They're sort of a cross between comics history, criticism. There's an element of personal memoir to mine, at least, and an element of New York history in mine as well. And it's all sort of jumbled together in a whatever kind of stew we each wanted to put into it. They were very open about that, I found. Did you guys agree?
Yeah. I mean, this is a book I've been wanting and aiming to write for decades. Mm-hmm. And so when they actually emailed me and said, would you like to write some sort of book about Marvel? I said, I've got this one I want to write. So very specifically.
Nice. Would you like to fulfill your dreams? Yes, I would.
Yeah, and I was largely the same way. Like, I'm a big fan of Bloomsbury. He has a book series called 33 and a Third, where they basically go to musicians or music journalists, music historians, and have them write about their favorite concert or their favorite live album or whatever the case may be. And so I used to think, like, wouldn't that be cool if there was something like that for comics? So we didn't just have to write blog posts and other things, but we could actually be legitimized by a real publisher. And so I think this kind of signifies that we're all entering our historian phase of working in the comic industry. So yeah, when Marvel reached out and said, would you have any interest in helping launch this line? Like, absolutely. So I had a few different books that I really wanted to do. And so I'm glad they picked one that I most wanted to do. But yeah, I mean, just being able to be handed 30,000 words to talk about why something that we love is great and influential and impactful and lasting was a thrill.
Yes. One of the things that I really like about this, and I think people probably got a sense based on how I was describing them, but they're three very different books. It's not like Daredevil, the true story, Doctor Strange, the true story, etc. Like, you're giving them very different focuses that seem, like you're saying, very personal to you. So just to kind of like start with yours, Chris, if you don't mind, since you are diving very specifically into, I'll get these to work. There we go. Tiny little windows. Into Daredevil Born Again. I mean, for you, why was this the right topic?
So it's funny, in part, like, you could say it was sort of a mercenary thing. So I'm like, I really want to get one of these approved. And if I pick one that has the same title as a big Disney Plus show, maybe that maximizes my chances. Yeah. But it also just so happens that Born Again is my all-time favorite superhero storyline. And so I love the idea of digging into, like, why I think those seven issues are so impactful and resonant and all of that, even decades later. But then as it went along and I saw what Paul and Stuart were doing, I got a little envious that, like, I could have widened my reach a bit and talked more about, you know, how Frank Miller got me into ninjas and everything from his first run on the book. But instead, I just did spend the entire book telling why I think Born Again is so great. And I'm happy I did, because, like I say, it is my all-time favorite superhero storyline.
Nice. Well, I think that's the superpower, pun happening, of this anyway, where it's like, the pinpoint of some of these books is really nice. It makes it feel personal just by the form in addition to the content.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they are all different, that they take on different scopes, that yours is very focused. I think Itasha Womack's is also quite focused. That's coming up on Miles Morales' upcoming volume.
Yeah.
Paul's and mine basically each span a year of a character or a comics, 10 years, a decade of a character or comics history, two particular different effects.
Well, why don't we talk about one of those, moving on to Paul's book, The Mighty Avengers versus the 1970s. Why was this your dream book?
Well, I just think it's really interesting. I mean, this is a run I largely read at the time. And not only is some of this material very personal to me, but I think it maps so well that amazing decade. There's basically only three and a bit major writers of the Avengers across the 1970s, and they each take radically different approaches to this material. And all of their approaches are influenced tremendously by the social change erupting around them. And so it's an extraordinary mirror to the times. And I'm there's a particular issue, the first American import comic I ever found on a British newsagent as a child. It's in the middle of the Avengers Defenders War. And I still kind of view it as a platonic ideal of a superhero comic. I find it impossible to view it objectively. And so it's kind of passing out from each writer what they wanted to do and trying to deal with that on its own terms, to do comics critique about the actual business of comics writing on the creative level, to you know, try and judge superhero comics by what they're trying to do.
Nice, that's beautiful.
I mean, it's interesting to focus on this era. This is my very narrow view of it, obviously, but I certainly think that the 60s is like, that's the dawn of the Marvel Age, right? And the 80s, that was certainly when I was really starting to get into comics, but that's a revolution in terms of getting darker with things like The Dark Knight, and then also the dawn of crossovers and everything like that. And to me, a little bit, the 70s feel like a lost era, but that's obviously not your take on it at all.
Oh, no.
Why are you picking a fight with him, Alex? I mean,
I'm
geez.
Trying to fight with Paul. That's what's going on.
I mean, I think the 1970s was where you get some effortlessly adult comics that still stay within the comics code. Basically, the entire work of Steve Gerber. There's a lot of this material is extremely sophisticated, and I think we lost some of that sophistication after the 1970s. So no, I think the Bronze Age, you know, I'm not one to slag off modern comics at all. I adore modern comics, current comics, but the 70s has a wonderful, powerful flavor of its own, and I really prefer it to the decades on either side.
Well, if I can quickly just talk of this one a little bit too. The nice thing about this and the timing of the launch of these books is this works as kind of a nice elegy for the writing of Jim Shooter. You know, when Jim Shooter passed last year, there's all the conversation like Jim Shooter was complicated. In the 70s, he wasn't complicated. He wrote great comic books. And I think this book does a great job of summing up, you know, why Shooter's Avengers comics were so good and just so also so lasting and worth talking about in this kind of book.
Yeah, I would add too that to me a lot of the charm of the 1970s at Marvel in particular is the place was utter chaos. there was like one editor trying to cover the entire line. It was impossible to do. The writers were basically their own editors and they had to sort of keep track of stuff. By all accounts, Steve Gerber and Don McGregor were the two proofreaders and they had a mutual agreement to just leave each other's shit alone, like they wouldn't. So like there was just stuff like that happening, and that led to a lot of sort of mediocre, forgettable comics, but it also led to a lot of brilliant books that would have been hard to squeak through in a more organized time.
Yeah, that's been my thought. My understanding of it is it was like sort of a Wild West where you could be really psychedelic either in your work or just in at your lunch hour and still be writing some fantastic comics. So that's my takeaway. So I'm excited to check this out.
Let's talk about your book then, Stuart, Doctor Strange, A Decade of Dark Magic. Again, not to be too repetitive, but why Doctor Strange? Why was this your pick of the book to do?
Well, I've probably told this story before, but when I was a kid, I mostly read DC books. And then when I was 16, a friend of mine sat me down with this giant stack of Marvels, and it just changed my life. Like, it just like, so most people I know in the comics industry as kids were fans of one company or the other. And to me, they're different. Like, DC are my friends from childhood, sort of, but Marvel to me is the exciting and the wild stuff. And one of the things that was in those piles was the early 1970s Doctor Strange by Steve Englehart and John Brunner, which is where this book starts and then sort of flashes back to the original Stan Lee and Steve Ditko stuff. And Chris mentioned the 33 and a third books from Bloomsbury, and this series is patterned directly on those, though they're larger form. Ours are larger format and have color illustrations, but they're handled by the same editorial team. And when I was getting ready to write this, I picked up a volume of that by the writer Jonathan Latham on the Talking Heads album Fear of Music, and I think I probably took too much away from that because I that's where all the self-indulgent shit that Chris was talking about comes in, where I sort of bring my own life into it and discovered that while the early Doctor Strange stories in particular, and this is mostly the influence of Steve Ditko, I think, but they're set very not just in New York, where all the Marvel early Marvels were set, but in the East Village specifically. And I sort of wound up, and this was, I was writing around the same time the film A Complete Unknown was about to come out. And there's all these sort of parallels with places I used to go when I was younger in that area, and where I tracked down the address of Dr. Strange's house, and it was this giant fluorescent washed bodega with signs for energy drinks. And it said, "Drink Goose, be happy," all over it. And I don't know what to make of that. We decided it was Wong doing a spell of concealment.
Just an illusion, yeah.
Yeah, it's just to throw people off the path. But all that sort of wound up in the whole thing, along with a discussion of how the strip evolved, what happened when Ditko left, which he left rather suddenly, and who had to carry it on after that, and how the early 70s stuff was a real revival and a sort of an attempt to push the whole thing to the next level.
Awesome. Something that we talk about a little bit, and I know this isn't necessarily the area you're talking about, but it feels like people struggle a little bit with Doctor Strange as a character. You know, you have those early stories, and there's been some great runs even over the past decade or so. But yeah, why do you think that is? Why do you think people sort of hit a wall with this character in particular?
Well, like Thor, it's a character who doesn't fit neatly into the Marvel Universe because he's mostly concerned with realms beyond. He's not as street level. Like he's mostly concerned with realms beyond Earth. That can be fascinating. One thing I noticed after rereading every Doctor Strange story from that 10-year period is that even for a Marvel character, he talks to himself a lot.
Very chatty.
I think that's because he doesn't really have a sidekick, at least until Clea comes into it kind of late in these stories. But also he's often just sort of trying to puzzle out where he is, what's going on. And one of the things I guess that might be a distancing thing about him. He's very much a loner, and especially the stories we tend to remember most often take place in bizarre otherworldly realms, which is what makes the stories cool, really. But maybe it's not for everyone. I don't know.
Well, I always remember those stories. And Doctor Strange would be having his adventure while also telling you like a sci-fi short story at the same time. He's just explaining. He has to do so much like laying ground of like, so here's the crazy thing about this dimension. Everyone's hats are their heads and their heads are their hats. And it's like, okay. And then he walks through how it all works and then has to solve the mystery.
Yeah, he's often figuring it out for himself while he's telling you. Yeah. The first Dark Dimension story is kind of interesting because Clea's a native of that realm. And she's almost like a Greek chorus explaining to him what's going on, which is kind of interesting. It makes her almost the host of the whole thing. And that allows their relationship to build at the same time.
Chris, I'm curious to go back to Daredevil Born Again. This versus, say, a decade of Doctor Strange and a decade of the Avengers, like you're talking about, that's a very focused thing that certainly has been reported on a lot. So where are the pockets? What did you find out that was surprising or interesting to you about Daredevil Born Again? Or did you have it all in your encyclopedia up there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is the way it explores the question of identity and also just what it takes to be a hero. And you know, there's a lot of sort of tearing down of characters and then building them back up and doing the heroic rise kind of thing. But rarely is it ever as gripping and sort of, I don't know, the character being put through such drastic paces as happens in this book. Like Matt Murdock's entire life is destroyed, and it's destroyed not in this grandiose way at the start, but in this really sad, quiet way where Karen Page, who is his blonde actress girlfriend, you know, from the comics in the 60s and early 70s, she disappeared for like a decade. She went off to Hollywood to go make it as an actor. And then the next time we see her, she shows up here and she's strung out and she's in a dingy motel room and she has nothing of value that she can still give except for Matt Murdock's secret or Daredevil's secret identity. And so when that reaches a kingpin, he doesn't do the big supervillain thing of, you know, attacking him and blowing up his hell, although he does do that too, but he just kind of systematically destroys his entire life. He has his power turned off. He ends up getting Matt just barred. And it's just sort of all these real world things that can happen happens to him. And it's, it's just not one of the things where the hero's identity leaks and is sort of dealt with and put back and resolved easily by the end of the storyline. You know, and I was always used to, I don't know, Spider-Man gets seen with his mask off and he hires Hobie Brown to dress up as Spider-Man to come in and gaslight Gwen Stacy and to go, no, I'm Spider-Man, not this guy. Or Clark Kent, you know, uses a Superman robot to throw Lois Lane off his trail and the identity thing is restored by the end of an issue. This is just seven harrowing issues of his identity being figured out by the worst person in the world to have that information and then systematically destroying every part of his life except for that one little thing, that one tiny piece that makes him a hero. Kingpin never takes that from him. And I just find all of it just still so... I almost get choked up about it because it is just such a perfect example of what makes somebody a hero, how they just can, I don't know, come back from such terrible odds and still find that thing, find the way to keep moving forward and never let anything that you're put through sort of keep you down. So those are the things that I really found just so lasting. And then just the impact that almost every other story that's come since then where a hero's identity is figured out, you know, as like when Bendis did it in Daredevil or Ed Brubaker picked up from Bendis, you could tell that this was the story that was influencing everything that came after it.
Yeah. Definitely.
Well, and on that, I feel like all three of these books have been fodder for like the media development, like movies and TV and the MCU. Why? And these stories are at the youngest 40 plus years old. So why are these the stories? Is it the creators? They were influential to the creators or just the power of the story themselves? Like,
and what you mean is why did we read these comics when we were clearly only maybe 2 or 3 years old at the time, right?
Yes, exactly. Why are we so smart as babies?
I think part of the original concept for this line of books was that there was going to be one book from each decade of Marvel's existence. And it hasn't worked out exactly that way so far. And mine overlaps a couple decades, but it sort of worked out that way. Like, once we get to Miles Morales, that'll bring it a little more into the present day. So yeah, we were all just sort of asked what we wanted to do, and Bloomsbury was trying to sort of give a spread of different time periods and different points in Marvel's history.
Yeah, awesome. Paul, you mentioned that you have some very specific chapters in terms of looking like Roy Thomas, Jim Shooter, but there is one, I don't know if you want to leave this for people to discover when they read the book, but you have a chapter called The Greatest Fill-In.
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything you can tell us about that?
Well, I do an entire chapter about the single issue that Steve Gerber writes of The Avengers, which is a masterpiece and dissects what it is to be a superhero. It's basically the Beast. In the issue after all of the Avengers were seen lying apparently dead at the hands of Michael, the great cosmic power enemy created by Jim Shooter, we joined the Beast in a disco. And he is merciful to a man who attacks him. He ruminates with his potential girlfriend on why he's in the superhero business. After about 14 pages, a supervillain shows up and who turns out to be mind-controlling both the Beast and, in the end, the secret agents who are paying for this whole project to happen on behalf of a government who one day want to control superheroes. But perhaps there's an even higher power at work. It's a like all the best short stories, it leaves open questions at the end. And it's an extraordinary thing to find in an issue of The Avengers, particularly immediately after they've all been apparently killed.
So there is a good Bloomsbury book that sort of looks at the hangover issues following amazing runs.
That's a good idea.
After Born Again, the next issue is a Steve Ditko comic where Daredevil fights Madcap, who is this goofy Mark Gruenwald sort of ambush bug-like character. And it didn't pick up at all from Born Again. And it was just such a weird sort of letdown, but also just curious moments in time where like that issue follows the Avengers Michael saga. And I'm fascinated by those, the weird fill-ins.
I agree. And during the pandemic, a website asked me for recommendations of like just outstanding back issues, and that was one of the two I picked, was that fill-in.
We got a question here from the comments on YouTube. Schreikler says, you all have varying experiences, not just writing comics, but analysis, criticism, prose, fiction, and more. What was something you brought to these books that you didn't expect to?
I might have actually met Dr. Strange in the course of writing this book. I didn't expect that.
Whoa.
How was he? Was he nice?
Was he on the subway? Or what was...
Now who's on acid?
It's Stuart. It's in the epilogue. It's there.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I think I probably got better or more astute at really sort of being able to define what makes great art, at least to me. Before, I was kind of like Homer Simpson when he discovers the word power. The art is very, very, very good. But, you know, this, I mean, when you're talking about David Mazzucchelli's art and sort of the evolution of his style throughout these seven issues, like it requires really paying attention and sort of understanding the influences and being able to define, you know, what he did that made it so special, and sort of the parsity of lines, how he could communicate so much with so little, and just getting a better understanding of how to, I don't know, effectively communicate what I found so effective about that art instead of just throwing praise at it, which I also did.
I suppose on the way in, I was thinking part of this is, oh, I'll get some really juicy gossip from the interactions between these creators. And actually, I decided before I started to put my final manuscript together, what I want to be is kind to all these people, all these kids who were in their teens and early 20s, whose small internal battles between each other really shouldn't be ruminated over decades later by people who weren't in the room. So I try and be incredibly even-handed and give everybody the credit for the work they did, and not dwell on the nasty stuff. And I'm really pleased by that approach. I think it opens more doors than it closes. Yeah, and nice. there's a depiction here of a major problem between Steve Englehart and Jerry Conway. And those are two wonderful chaps who, I would really hope that perhaps, I doubt this account will do it, but I hope someday somebody gets those two around a table and says, you know, you both did great work. Are we really going to, you know, still be focused on one weekend all those decades ago?
Well, so there's a bit at the end of Born Again where the Avengers show up and they're never named. Like anybody who's read Marvel Comics knows that's Thor. And when they talk about Captain America having a voice that could command a god and did, you know, you understand that that is the essence of Captain America, and you don't have to name that character. But there's these apocryphal stories that Jim Shooter had the heavy hand from above saying, no, Frank, you absolutely need to name every character because every issue is somebody's first issue. And so I want all the Avengers named in that comic, and it became this big heated thing, and there was a subterfuge to add the captions, but then print the book without the captions and tell Jim, oh, the printer screwed up. And turns out all of that, in talking to Bob Harris, the editor on this, that was all bullshit. And so somehow Jim got maligned falsely all these years of this story that sort of became accepted fact that wasn't true. And so that was another thing that I learned, was just, you know, digging into the history and talking to some of the people that made these comics were more nuanced and less sort of antagonistic as has been portrayed over time.
Wow. I think Chris addressed this a little bit already in terms of what you took back from this process. You talking about, Chris, talking about the art and getting more eloquent about it, which I'm not doing right now. But Paul and Stuart, what about you? What did you take back? Like, what did you learn that you are now taking back to your process as creators from crafting this book?
Well, one thing I learned was that when I was a kid, the the 70s stuff was really mind-blowing, and I appreciated the sort of looseness of it, but also the philosophy behind it. And I didn't see that so much in the Stan Lee, Steve Ditko works, but it's there. It's just a little further back, and it's probably mostly Ditko. Like what I sort of pieced together from their collaboration is that Ditko was the one who was, I mean, he's famous. There have been several books about him written just in recent years. And everyone knows that he was an objectivist. He had very strong political feelings, which came out in his later indie work. But I think he was more concerned with the sort of otherworldliness and the philosophy of the whole thing, where Stan was concerned with, to Stan, I think Dr. Strange was kind of like, he was like the Stan Lee of the East Village. Like he was this cool guy who was sort of all the beatniks kind of admired. And so I sort of pieced that together. In terms of what I learned writing, though, I realized there was a subtler philosophy in those stories than I had noticed when I was a kid. It's just not spelled out as much.
That's really, Stan Lee thought of himself as sort of a Doctor Strange. Stan Lee thought of himself as sort of like a Spider-Man. Stan Lee thought of himself as sort of like a Hulk character.
Paul, was there anything you took back to your creative process?
I guess a tremendous love of Steve Englehart. Just reading the whole run again back to back. His Celestial Madonna saga not only lands a good ending in superhero comics, which is almost never done, but brings together themes about how anybody can be redeemed. Even little in-jokes like the whole saga starts with a clever trick involving the Space Phantom and ends with a clever trick involving the Space Phantom. It's a magnificently shaped piece of work. And I think that's just not appreciated enough these days.
I was honestly so happy to see you explain some of that because I never understood Mantis and the Swordsman and the Kotati and the Celestial Madonna. Like, it just never landed in my brain when I read that stuff. So thank you for clarifying it in your book.
I think you just have to read it in one go. It's a graphic novel, basically.
It's very clear how much you guys are just huge fans of each of your works in this line. It's awesome to hear the enthusiasm even now as it's coming out. But is there, these are like have real, historical heft. What's the shameless comic history story that you want to tell? The deeply personal, like, if I could, I would tell this story.
You mean related to the characters in these books?
Unrelated to this book. Anything. Just in, I'm struck by how, like, these are the big stories that you've been wanting to tell. What are the little, like,
Justin, you're asking, what are the ones that are definitely not going to sell any copies, but you would be
that no one would want?
So badly want to do a new universe book and look at why it was just a spectacular failure almost immediately. Like, didn't make it to month two before there were fill-in artists and writers and everything just completely collapsed. And we all so badly, as kids of the 80s, wanted the world outside our window to be our Marvel universe. We were getting all these first issues, all these amazing creators, and none of it worked. I mean, bits of it worked. DP7 was fine, but there's a book there that delves into like all the different ways it just didn't work. And I would love to do that. And I cannot see Marvel approving me.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah, that's really funny. I feel like people don't even know about that anymore.
Right.
The new universe is just completely fallen away.
Very obviously, the Man Thing. The Man Thing. The work of Steve Gerber at its height, the Man Thing. I rest my case.
Yeah. Well done. Great, that would sell in certain parts of a bookstore, I think. Stuart, what about you?
You'll be so scared to not buy it.
Nothing's coming immediately to mind. I think Paul and I probably could do a whole volume together on that Steve Gerber fill-in on the Avengers, and that probably nobody would be too interested in that probably either.
We do have a related question here for the comments. This is from Derek Mainhart. You don't really hear Steve Englehart's name anymore. Mm-hmm. Are there other creators that you'd like to shine a light on in these or other books?
I have a name that I almost brought up earlier because he was the writer that did great stuff on both Doctor Strange and the Avengers after the era these guys wrote about, which is Roger Stern. Mm-hmm. I feel like Roger Stern wrote characters, like almost every character in Marvel Universe he wrote well. and kind of did these defining runs at the time that just nobody talks about anymore. Like, he wrote one of the best Doctor Strange runs that I've ever seen. I thought he did a great Avengers, you know, where he elevated the Wasp and the Monica Rambeau, Captain Marvel, and sort of made the female characters sort of the most powerful and important parts of the team in an era where that just wasn't done a lot. And I just feel like Roger Stern is a guy sort of post Engelhart that deserves, I don't know, that same sort of recognition and admiration.
I would want to mention Gene Colan, the artist who did a lot of things at Marvel, was known largely for Tomb of Dracula and Howard the Duck. But his late 60s Doctor Strange, his first run on the book, is some of his most beautiful work. It shows a lot of design experimentation, but it's very, very human. And the stories are loose enough that he's able to really stretch out and do all kinds of cosmic trippy stuff. It's just beautiful all around. And I hadn't really read those before.
I mean, I would second both of those tremendously. I'd like to mention Bob Brown, the artist on my first and perfect Avengers issue, who's actually a bit of a master of the form, but you never hear his name. I think Bob Brown deserves more recognition.
And, you know, Bob Brown and Gene Colan both have a good history on Daredevil, too.
That's true. Yeah.
We're coming up with a new book, guys. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
Listen, this project is so cool. Before we start to wrap up here, though, you always do, as we keep mentioning, have tons of other things going on. So just to give you a second to plug whatever you'd like to plug, Stuart, why don't we start with you? Anything else people should be checking out?
I wrote a book called Captain America for Dummies that came out in this past February, and that's still available. And there may be another Dummies book coming. I can't talk about it yet. But
nice.
I have
looking off screen like there's someone telling you don't talk about the Dummies book.
Don't shoot. I had a graphic novel called Meet with the brilliant Matt Howers that just came out from Cosmic Lion Productions. And I wrote a story for Toxic Avenger Team Up with Ahoy Comics, where I do publishing operations as well. That'll be collected in the trade paperback in January. And I also wrote a very goofy and strange introduction for that book.
Awesome. Paul, what about you?
I've got a graphic novel out now with the amazing cartoonist Rachel Smith called Who Killed Nessie? Which is about, there's a convention of cryptids where, you know, Bigfoot and the Yeti gather every year, and unfortunately this year there's been a murder and it's Nessie. Proper whodunit, charming cartooning, comedy, cozy. It's gorgeous.
That sounds amazing.
And Chris, what about you?
By the way, I read Paul's book. Me and Paul are both 40, and so anything to do with cryptids and UFOs and aliens, I think we're both marks for. So let's see. My Francis Ford Coppola Megalopolis graphic novel with Jacob Phillips on art came out last month. And then early next month, I do a Christmas horror anthology called Dread the Halls through Image, and that comes out on December 3rd. And on the editorial front, I've been John Byrne's editor on an X-Men project, which feels really weird to me to say, because being an editor on a John Byrne X-Men book doesn't feel like it should be happening in 2025, and it's very exciting. So
that's exciting.
Volume 1 actually wraps this week and will be out in the spring of next year. And
is that weird, sorry, and cool. To interrupt, that's the thing where I'm getting some of the details wrong here, but he created tons of issues to continue his run in a different direction, and they just never got published. Is that
right?
Yeah.
So yeah, you got those details right. In fact, he did 31 issues on his website years ago. He just penciled and wrote 31 issues for fun. Basically, that envisioned a world where X-Men continued on if he'd never left the title, and so it picks up sort of post Death of Phoenix. Although in this case, it's the original ending, so Phoenix is lobotomized and stays alive. And so we got the issues inked, colored, lettered professionally. You know, it's going to be put out through Abrams Marvel Arts line, and it'll be three different graphic novels. And it's full on 80s John Byrne X-Men. And it's just been a thrill and a blast to work on.
That's bonkers that is finally getting released. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Awesome. So cool.
Well, cool. Guys, congrats again. Yeah. These books are so cool.
Great books.
I'm glad you all got to do them because, like Justin was saying, you seem so excited about them. So congrats again.
And thanks for all your work. We really appreciate it.
We'll have you back for the Man Thing book for sure.
Yes, definitely.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye, y'all.
All right. Once again, just to read off the name of the books, they're all part of the Marvel Age of Comics from Bloomsbury. You got Daredevil Born Again by Chris Ryle, Doctor Strange, A Decade of Dark Magic by Stuart Moore, and the Mighty Avengers versus the 1970s. Find out who wins from Paul Cornell. And they're all in stores now, so you can pick up all three books, and they're really, really cool, as we keep saying.
Yes. Yeah.
There we go. Other things that are cool, I'll tell you what, are your audience questions.
Oh, there really is.
Man, what the heck happened here?
I couldn't find the sound cue for a second. That's what happened. But I found it. It's my favorite section because you make it up. All you got to do is drop a question in the comments. Could be about absolutely anything, and we'll get to them. But guys, while we're waiting for those questions to come in, what you drinking tonight, Pete? You're having a little garage beer, I'm guessing?
That's correct, sir. Well done.
You don't have a garage beer, but you do have a garage? Is that how it goes?
I have a garage beer, not a garage.
Oh, so garage beer is where you take the runoff when it rains from your gutter.
How dare you? How
dare you? Put it in the cup, shake it up, put it in the fridge for a couple months.
Yeah. That has nothing to do with beer.
Can you taste the leaves, or how does it work?
That's gross.
The squirrels? The squirrel activity?
Taste the squirrel. Gutter beer.
Taste the squirrel. That's what the Kelsey brothers say. Pete, how many of those do you buy at a time? Because I can't tell if you drink one every Tuesday or if you're just have a Costco-style forklift of them in here.
Yeah, it depends on the weekend, but usually it's just on Tuesdays. But
You don't have a garage, but you do have a space the size of a garage filled with garage
filled with beer,
It's a garage made out of beer. Much better. I'm drinking.
Look at you. Come on.
It's the mustache talking. I didn't know.
Look at that shit.
I'm a real hoser, and I'm ready to play some hockey.
All right. We got a couple of questions here. This is from Michael Tillman. Says, which cryptid character would you take to a murder mystery party?
Would we take?
Well, there was a. There was that great comic where it was like, Sasquatch was a detective, and he had like a whole group of cryptids he worked with. What was that book? It was so good.
Probably called Sasquatch Detective or something.
I was going to say it was called Detective Sasquatch.
Could be one.
It was so good. He was like a Yeti or something. And
I vaguely remember what you're talking about.
I do remember this as well. And I think that was...
Yes, so you'd say either a Yeti or a
Proof. Sense. That's what it was. Thank you, Matthew.
Yes,
Schofield coming through in the clutch.
Book.
Yeah,
great call. Deep cut from Peter LePage. Deep down in the old garage brain.
Had to dust it off.
Matthew, so proud of his work. very dramatic. Which cryptid would I take? Probably one of The Shape of Water?
That guy. Oh, yeah.
Is he a cryptid? I guess he probably
is. Oh, yeah.
I think so.
Sure. Yeah.
Is this so you could have sex with him later? Is that why?
Yeah, it's very sexual. It's a date. It's a date.
For sure. Yeah. I would say the Jersey Devil, he's probably fun to party with.
No, wow.
Really?
You and Derek Mainhart.
Yeah.
Oh, we said the same thing. Twinsies.
Same time.
That's trashy. I find that to be a trashy answer, Alex.
Derek Maynard says, what's the best forgotten era of CBC?
Forgotten? Ooh. I guess I've forgotten every night except for tonight so far.
Yes. I would say the secret Pete shows that he had back when we were at the pit, where, full disclosure, we'd be struggling for audience every week. And then Pete would be like, okay, you guys are gone. No problem. Sell out the entire venue.
Well, it's like if you could buy tickets to a car accident, you would have gotten if you know it.
How dare you, sir? How dare you?
Nope. You would actually really turn up for those shows. You would book the whole thing. You would have segments, very intense segments, I remember. I mean, I was in disguise in the audience watching for all of them.
Yeah. And I don't think, I think that was pre-podcast. So those.
Yeah, those don't exist. That's the thing about doing live comedy, man. That, was a moment in time.
It was all live. I mean, the Alex rant, the.
Oh, yeah. When You Quit Comics was a good one. I immediately go back to the the pickle days when we were running around the streets. Yeah,
that
in
is
New
a
York.
Good forgotten era. Pulp Secret era for sure. Yeah,
aren't those still out there though? Can't we
I
find
don't
those?
No. Maybe.
I wonder if I have.
I don't know how the internet works.
But yes, when Pete calls it the pickle era, it involves maybe a little more explanation when we were roving reporters for a comic book news website that we were. Yep. We were journalists.
And we were covering your love of pickles, as I recall, or what was that all about?
Let me be honest, though. I feel like I used the quote-unquote skills we got from that job where it was like, we need to make this interesting somehow. I used that today when I was working on some scripts for some stuff. Yep. So it's like, that was a formative time in my career.
Schoikler asks, what comic runner era would you write a detailed analysis of?
Oh, great question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Wow. I'd love to do Eastman and Laird's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that's for sure.
Probably. Probably one of those X-Men crossovers I like Inferno would be maybe the least interesting one, but like Mutant Massacre or Fall of the Mutants, something like that, because that feels like the sort of thing like, hey, Mutant Massacre, we came up with an idea to slaughter a bunch of mutants in the sewers. Isn't that cool? Would be interesting to get into the headspace of what led to that.
I would do a couple, two that come to mind. Zero Hour from DC, I feel like was... You know, talking about a time in mainstream comics when big experimentation was happening, I feel like Zero Hour was very strange. Obviously, selfishly, Starman came out of that.
There was a lot of weird books there.
And Starman specifically, I feel like, built a big community in the back matter, which was the first comic in my experience that was not just throwing letters in and answering them, was really connecting people. And, you know, it was pre most internet. So
sure
it felt
was,
like,
buddy.
Feel like there's something there that it actually
community,
does have
yeah.
historical resonance of how we read comics now.
But that's
the other
why
one I would say is Bone, the history of Bone, because it's sort of an interesting from funny books through Image and all that.
But that's why the three guests were so great at the books that they're doing, because they were coming at it from a point of passion. Like, I would love to hear Justin talk about Starman because he's a huge Starman fan. And why does he love Starman so much? And what about it, you know, makes it so special for him? And same for Bone. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's why they did such a great job on the books that they did.
Derek wants to know, can we hear more about these Secret Pete shows? Pete, you were there. You want
to? No. Oh, sure.
He has to tell it.
I mean, I think one of the funner reveals for me personally was when I had to tell an old roommate that we would go comic book shopping together, that like I swapped out one of his comics for one of my comics, because it was, you remember when Wolverine lost his claws and they like the different print runs had different colored claws, like it was like the silver claws, the gold claws, and then, you know, like another one. And I didn't get the newer run, and my buddy did. So like that was a fun reveal, like tell him live on stage that I had stolen his comic. And
just to provide a little context here, so the thing with the Pete shows was, you had, was it Chris Griggs co-hosted with you?
And no, it was my buddy 4-0.
Your buddy 4-0. So you had basically
I just
a bunch of buddies,
friends,
and then you packed
yeah.
the audience with tons of your friends, the people that you refused to introduce us to, despite us knowing each other for almost 2 decades.
We're friends, but we don't know Pete's friends, and we don't know where Pete lives.
Yeah. And as far as we heard, they were just like that. These packed wild parties where Pete's friends went absolutely nuts. So there you go.
Well, you would bring friends on stage, and then they would bring friends, and it just became a thing. But
are you sure? Did you have a show? Was it a show, or was it like a party? Were you just having a party?
It was both. It was both. It was definitely the after hours after the shows were just so much fun, because then all your friends are at the bar, which is the perfect scenario.
Well, I wish I could have guessed it on one of those shows.
Yeah, too bad. Too bad.
Didn't we? There was a show where Pete hosted and we were the guests. I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, I think Justin was a guest one time, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And then Straight Bullets talking about the Arrow Corner. I mean, yeah, we had some fun, man. We had some fun.
That was pretty Arrow, I think.
Speaking of which, Stray Bullet has a nice tee-up slash question, which is, are you guys going to mention the Comic Book Club book club? For sure. So we've been talking about this in the Patreon Discord. Again, patreon.com/comicbookclub. But we came up with this crazy idea to have a book club for Comic Book Club. So there was a big vote that went on the Discord. We're going to be reading Droom by Jesse Lonergan.
Oh, yes.
To be determined. We're going to get together and just like actually have it as a book club. Like this won't be recorded as a podcast. We're not going to put up the video anywhere other than for potentially Patreon folks who couldn't necessarily be there. But this is just a Patreon thing to hang out and chat about a graphic novel that we'll be doing sometime in December. So if you're interested, again, patreon.com/comicbookclub. It's as low as $2 a month. There's tons of bonuses. You get to hang out in Discord. Very fun.
I'm so excited to talk about that book.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about it too and just hang out and chat about a graphic novel. And hopefully it works and we'll keep that going every month and see what happens. So
yeah,
there you go.
How could it not work?
Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
Pablo says, what is the worst comic book somebody recommended you guys and why?
I've never read a bad comic. All comics are a little
That's worst comic somebody recommended. I don't know. I don't really have a good answer for that.
Yeah, I just
most of the time if somebody recommends it, like I feel like there's this pressure if you're recommending a comic, like it's got to be good. You got to actually like you're going to bat for something because if the other person doesn't like it, then you've lost all credibility forever.
Well, and especially like we're a comic, you know, we've been doing this long enough that like we're known comic book guys. If someone's recommending something to us, it's like, that'd be weird if they were like, yeah, it's bad.
I mean, it's weird because when Alex gets excited about a book, I get like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to like this. But there's never been like a thing where...
Cool.
What? We have different tastes, man.
Yeah, I know. When you get excited about something, I'm excited for you because you're happy. But go ahead. Go off, King.
Oh, Jesus. I just don't have an instance where someone was like, oh, you got to check this out. And I was like, oh, I hate this. But I just know sometimes...
We do that every week on the stack. So
it's
hard
that.
To say that, really.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I mean,
Hattush. Mainhart, I'm excited about it.
Yes. He says, did anyone recommend Hattush? Not yet. Nobody has recommended Hattush for
me. I recommend Hattush.
Yes. Oh, well, there you go. Great.
Perfectly illustrating Pablo's question.
And that is it for your audience questions. Whoop, 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 whoop. We are going to move on with our next section, which is trivia. And for that, we're going to turn it over to Pete LePage.
All right. This is the part we give back to you, the lovely audience. It's an opportunity to win 25 free dollars to Midtown Comics Online. Because if you had 25 bucks, you'd probably want to go to a comic book shop. I mean, come on.
Come on.
Come on. Come on.
So we just need
Pablo
a first hand
up here.
Oh, Pablo's back with a vengeance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, sorry, Kurt Jensen.
Come back next week, Kurt.
Yeah, come
back
next
what's
week.
What's up? Shout outs to Kurt.
All
right.
We all have mustaches. Yeah. I mean, everyone has one. It's just these guys all have extra.
Hey, Justin, while we're talking about the mustache, like, how's your wife doing with it? Is she hated? Does she like.
While we're speaking about the mustache, how's your wife doing?
Yeah. She's single. Available.
What?
Is that what you mean, Pete?
No. No, I want you and your wife to be happy. I'm just worried that, you know, you show up one day with a mustache. Like, that's a big decision.
Well, yeah, you show up one day for a mustache. Suddenly your friend who lives somewhere, we don't know, shows up and swoops her off her feet. The man with a full beard.
Exactly. What a flex.
Yeah, she falls for the Santa look.
She loves Christmas. So.
What?
I smell a Hallmark rom-com that Pete would love to watch.
The Santa cheater.
Yeah.
No, hang on. Come on. Let him open up and share with us, please, Alex.
What is this question? Share what?
He said, how's my wife doing with a mustache? And I do actually have an answer because I said, hey, I'm going to shave a mustache because I'm playing Gallagher in this show. And she's like, no.
Wait, because you're playing Gallagher the video game or there's a character whose name is Gallagher?
Gallagher the video game?
Oh, Gallagher.
Gallagher.
I believe in Gallagher, you do shoot watermelons that are coming out.
I think in Gallagher, isn't it a mustache shooting little pew pews at the front of its little things? Mm-hmm. No, I was playing Gallagher, the fruit smashing 80s prop comedian who did thousands of shows a year. And she said, no, please don't do that. And I said, I must. And then I came home the next, I got up the next day and she turned to me and said, that mustache is really growing on me.
Wow. What a beautiful story.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that, but it is, it's still on my face. So.
Okay.
How about that for an answer?
And you are still married, so.
Yes. Why are you having air quotes around that, you little?
I don't know. You said still on my face in air quotes, so I just wanted to keep the bit going. You know what I mean?
Pablo has his hand up here, and we got to put it down for his circulation. So, Pete, why don't you take it away with trivia?
All right. Today's trivia is about the comic Superman Kryptonite Spectrum and a small nod to the legend, Drew Struzan. RIP, thanks for all the movie poster art. Okay, please listen to all three options.
I'm getting loose.
Before hearing the question, here we go. Question number one. Who writes the amazing comic Superman the Kryptonite Spectrum? Is it A, W. Maxwell Prince? B, to be frank, I wish your name was Frank Bryan. C, Brian Frank.
To be frank.
Mm-hmm. He probably gets that all the time, though. So,
yeah.
You know. That's a bad, let me just say, that's a bad name.
Brian Frank.
Brian Frank?
It's tough if your last name is Frank.
Those are two bad names put together.
Yeah. Oh, easy.
Is it A?
A is correct. Well done, Pablo. Here we go. Question number two. Who is the amazing artist on this fantastic comic? Is it A, Martin Morazzo? B, every time I see you, I laugh and think about Captain Raymond Holt on the Wheels of Steel. C, DJ Holt.
I was just shitting on the name Frank, and Spaceman Frank says, oh man, to be frank. Apologies, Frank. It's a
shout out to Spaceman Frank, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
well timed. Well timed, what's up?
Stray Bullet says we should smash fruit for $40 a month on Patreon. What do you guys think?
Oh, that'd be glorious. Yeah,
I got really good at smashing watermelons with a mallet.
Reasons. Whoa, what a flex. A is correct. Here we go, last one. This series features new and existing forms of kryptonite, like, is it A, speckled, B, fine, Sean, I'll bite. What's going to be the name of your cologne? C, Sean Sauvage.
I like when you take one step out. You're like a 70s Marvel writer, Zach. I'm going to be a little trippy with this one. That was your version of Beast going to the disco.
That's right. That's right.
Why is the Beast? The Beast as an Avenger is crazy.
Really? I don't know. I liked it. Him and Wonder Man together, that's fun stuff.
I agree that. But now Beast is such a bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed.
Is it A?
A is correct.
Congratulations, Pablo. You somehow beat trivia. Shoot us an email. Right. We will get you a gift card to Midtown Comics. Pete, what is the Drew Struzan movie you are referencing here?
Of course, I'm talking about the 2005 award-winning short, Blood Makes Noise. What?
Wait, you weren't doing the Drew Struzan documentary?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
What got you on this kick?
Well, first of all, amazing poster art. You know what I mean? The guy's an artistic legend, and he's no more. So I just want to take a moment to remember him.
Respectfully, when you're talking about posters like that, you know, I call them cool covers for the movies.
So. Oh, wow. Interesting.
Well, that's nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. You just peel them open, and the movie just unfolds.
It's right under there. That's right under there.
That's the secret of posters.
That's right. They don't tell you that.
Comics are like a series of posters, and new ones are coming out tomorrow. Pete, what are you looking forward to?
Oh, my gosh. Alex, thank you so much for asking me that. I'm looking forward to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Godzilla number one. It has all the things. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Godzilla, and Tim Seeley. Yes, please. Rogue Storm number two. Hell yeah, badass shit. And of course, Superman, the kryptonite spectrum number 4. I mean, are you looking for tripped out amazing art? Show up then.
Great. Justin, what about you?
Lots of fun stuff in this stack. We talked to Frank Barbieri last week about The Author Immortal. Number 2 comes out tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Really into mm-hmm. that book. Of course, Beneath the Trees, where nobody sees
before
coming out. That book is haunting. If you like,
yes!
If you like Breaking Bad or any like anti-hero piece of content, buy this
like
book.
Dexter.
This book is great to put into a hand of someone who doesn't read comics but would like to
it's
get into
as
it.
Fuck.
I gotta hit Nigh Loaded number 1, the return of Kieran Gillen's book from back in the day, which has really stuck with me as the years go by. And last thing I'll say is Redcoat number 15. A book that is just really fun. It's been such a surprise every month. I really
You guys covered a bunch of it, but the things that I'm really curious to check out: Event Horizon, Dark Descent, number 3 from IDW, really messed up prequel to the movie so far. Also, Colossal Kaya, number 1.
Yes, dude.
Read in a while. Pete, you're excited to read it since you haven't read it yet?
Yes, exactly. It's got amazing artists on it.
Yeah, it has an amazing group of artists. Excited to see them jam on.
Colossus. You're right. It is a group of artists.
Yes. And then what was the other thing that I wanted to call out? Oh, Poison Ivy Annual has Mark Buckingham on art, as well as G. Will
Buckingham.
Wilson. That is always good. And folks, that is it for this week's show. A couple of people we want to thank. We want to thank Chris Ryle, Stuart Moore, and Paul Cornell for coming out to talk about the Marvel Age of Comics.
Great
all
stuff.
3 of their books are now available through Bloomsbury and in stores everywhere, so check that out. Next week on the show, we have 2 great guests for you. John Dudley is going to be here for Big Shoulders, and Shelby Young, the voice of Batgirl in Batman High Volume, is going to be on the show. Comic Book Club News, our daily news show every Monday through Friday. Patreon.com/comicbookclub. Support this show and all the shows we do, as well as join our upcoming book club. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice. Comic Book Club on Blue Sky, Comic Book Club Live on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Yeah.
Good night. Eat the hand of my wife. Comic
Book Club. Hey, Justice Lord. I'm Ollie.
They always sit on crappy couches and they let the secrets leak. And occasionally they let that special guest speak. So grab your grin.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.